Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me today is Simon Lambert. And coming up, does earning 100 grand a year make you rich? Well, technically, yes. So why do so many people say no? This Is Money spoke to a top psychologist who has some tips on how to feel wealthier, whatever you earn. Also today, when do you think you'll have to keep working until? Less than a third of Gen X are on track for a good retirement. Energy bills are on the way up. To fix or not to fix, that is the question. And slashing cash ISAs won't make savers buy shares. Simon has been speaking to top investing expert Carol Knight. Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, as much as Simon bangs on about the tax implications of earning £100,000, it is still a very decent wage. You are in the top 4% in the country of wage earners and on three times what the average worker takes home every year. And yet 9 in 10 Britons earning £100,000 or more a year before deductions do not view themselves as wealthy. So what is going on here? Simon, what is this research? Anyone listening to this who's not earning £100,000 or more, which I imagine is a few of our listeners, must think we've gone mad. Or that we've just been given massive pay rises.
Right. What's going on here? This is an absolutely excellent question, Georgie, because the UK's median wage full-time is £37,000. Now, that means that if you are earning £100,000, you are technically rich. Now, wealth is a different concept to rich, and they're used interchangeably. This HSBC Premier report, Your Money's Worth, Defining Wealth in 2025, talked about wealth. But it talked about wealth in the context of earnings, as in what number makes you wealthy if you're earning that amount. Generally, when we talk about wealth, we actually tend to talk about the assets that people have, and it's your property, your savings, your investments, your pension. And earning a high amount doesn't necessarily directly equate to that. So, for example, there'll be a lot of people who on paper are very wealthy in this country because they might be part of the baby boomer generation who've seen huge amounts of house price appreciation. They might have built up a lifetime of savings, investments, and have a decent pension pot, but they're actually now not on that much money in terms of earnings because perhaps they've retired and they've got their state pension and then their pension income. But this is specifically talking about earnings. And it said that despite being in the top 4% of earners, 9 in 10 Britons earning £100,000 or more do not view themselves as wealthy, as you said. It changes by region. But basically, people earning £100,000 or more, when they were asked about it, positioned themselves in the top 52% relative to the rest of the population, which is completely wrong. That's just above average. In fact, they are almost right at the top of the earnings tree. And if you look at the way this works, the chart of the way this works, the difference between the top 1% and the top 0.1% is really big. You know, those are the people earning the mega bucks. But to get into the top 1%, I think you need to be on about £150,000 a year. If you're earning, you know, more than kind of 70 or 80, you're definitely top 10%. But that's not how people think. And why don't people think that? Well, because to an extent, you spend to your means. And unless you're someone who is involved in extreme saving, fire, putting away loads and loads of money, chances are that if you're someone who's on a £100,000 salary, then you're spending pretty much most of your money because life is expensive. So you've got the house, for example. If you've got a mortgage, then that's going to be expensive. Or maybe you're paying rent. That's probably even more expensive. If you've got a car, that'll be expensive. If you've got living expenses, that'll be expensive. If you go on holiday, that'll be expensive. Now, some of these things are discretionary. Some of them are essential. Your energy bills are expensive. It's going to be a lot easier for you to cover the essentials than it is for somebody who's much lower down the income scale. But there's also a chance that your essentials are going to be more expensive than somebody's lower down the income scale, because chances are you might be living in a bigger home, for example. Also, it depends on someone's family structure. If you've got an individual living by themselves on £100,000, then they're going to be doing pretty well. If you've got two individuals with no children who are both earning £100,000, they've got dual income of £200,000 a year, they're going to be doing great. If you've got one person on £100,000 who's working and they've got children and a partner who doesn't work, or a partner who works and earns a much lower amount, then obviously it's going to change around there. And we did our own poll on this. I thought the findings were quite interesting, because usually when you would publish a story like this, you would get a load of comments where people go, that is absolutely ridiculous. That's a huge sum of money. You know, what are these people talking about? They're completely crazy. Now, there are some comments like this on the article, but there's actually a surprising number of comments saying, yeah, that's actually true. You know, they're doing all right. And there's no arguing that somebody on £100,000 a year isn't comfortably off and doing much better than most people, but they're not rich. And rich is being defined, or wealthy is being defined, as those earning a multiple of that amount. So we asked, what annual salary makes you wealthy in 2025? 73% of the people who voted, and bear in mind, 5,000 people have voted on this poll as we speak, 73% of them said it needed to be more than £150,000 a year. Of that, the largest chunk of votes came in for the £150,000 to £300,000 level. So once you went over £150,000, 26% said that's the point. But there was also 22% who said you needed to be earning £300,000 to £500,000 a year, and 23% said you needed to be earning £500,000, £500,000 a year. In comparison, it was only 14% of people who said 100 to 150 made you wealthy. And then there was 15% who said 75 to £100,000. So although actually technically £100,000 a year earning that does make you wealthy in the sense of what we're talking about being wealthy here, we're not talking about assets, as I explained, that's not what people think.
No, but then it depends, because like you said earlier, you need to know the context in which people are voting here. So as a woman with no kids, dinky, dual income, no kids issue, I went 150,000 to 300,000. Again, I live down south, so if I'd have lived when I lived back in the north, I probably would have gone 75,000 to 100,000. Again, if you are someone who earns over £100,000, the likelihood are, and maybe not, but a lot of your friends, your neighbours will be earning something like that. And then there's that awful thing about comparison, Simon. But is there something also a little bit real? We talk about, you know, social media, we talk about the comparison with our friends and our neighbours. But actually, the one that we compare, or the one I'm comparing to, is my parents. Is there something real to be said about, actually, they did have it easier than perhaps we do in this generation?
I think there is, and I think there's a couple of things going on there. Firstly, our parents' generation would argue that they did not have it easier, and that they dealt with double-digit interest rates and all those other things. However, I do believe, and the numbers back this up, that despite those things that they had to deal with, very high inflation at one point, double-digit interest rates at other points, and an extremely damaging recession in the early 90s, and that was a recession that actually some people never came back from, you know, and we have not seen that, even though we've managed to have the financial crisis and the COVID pandemic lockdowns in recent times. People were protected from those in a way that they were not protected from the early 1990s recession. And people lost houses, livelihoods, businesses. So actually, you know, they did have it tough in certain points. But it was easier to buy a bigger house. People benefited from defined benefit pension schemes. So usually final salary. That generation, I think, will have found it easier to save large sums of money and invest large sums of money. Certainly, if you look at the evidence that we have from the savings and investment pots that they have built up, and then you look at how today's generation or the generation in their kind of 30s and 40s is building up that up, they don't have the same level of wealth. You had very high inflation in the 1970s, but you had wages going up at the same level as inflation. Houses as a multiple of wages in the 1980s were considerably lower than they are now, largely due to much stricter caps on what you could borrow. So it just wasn't possible. It was much more common for somebody to be able to buy their first home or live a family lifestyle or move home on just one person's salary, whereas now it tends to be on two people's salaries. So there are all these things going on. Also, you need to look at tax as well. And the redefinition of what it means to be a higher rate taxpayer that has gone on over the past kind of 10 to 15 to even longer years. Now, one of the readers in our comments section of the original article we did on this said, it's not £100,000. It's about £55,000 after tax. That's a touch over £4,500 a month. Another one said, I earn £100,000 a year. You get taxed about 35% of that. So that's only £65,000. Now, I'm not sure exactly which one of these two numbers is correct for take-home pay. But
well, I'm on a take-home calculator, so let me check. I think it's about 68,000. It's £68,557.40. But of course, if you tick over that £100,000, so let's say £110,000, that's when you start losing your personal allowance. So
yeah,
that's when it starts to really eat. But 68,500. But if you were to use the 37,000 average figure, the take-home pay would be 30,000. So you're losing about £7,000 compared to £32,000.
It's a big difference there.
Big difference.
And what that figure that you gave there, the take-home, isn't taking into account is things like having to make a pension contribution and stuff like that. So the amount of money that people are getting, student loans as well, for example. You know, that's going to reduce it. And as you said, once you tick over that £100,000, you start losing your personal allowance and you fall into the 60% tax trap, which means that basically rather than being taxed income tax at an effective rate of 40% on the next pound you earn, you're taxed at 60%. So any pay rise you get, you're losing 60% of it. You also, thanks to the current system, if you've got kids and they're of your sort of younger nursery age, potentially going to lose free childcare, which creates like the most insane marginal tax rate ever. So I can't remember the exact number, but it's into the insanity figures. But if you look, interestingly, I was looking at this yesterday after we published the article, and I'm going to write something about this in the future in more depth. But in 1997, the higher rate tax threshold was £30,145. So that's when New Labour took over, right? Now that sounds like a pretty low figure to be paying 40% tax, only 30 grand. Until you uprate that for inflation, if it had been uprated with RPI inflation, the higher rate tax threshold today would be £74,000. It's not, it's £50,000. And we are in the middle of a colossal stealth tax raid where that figure is being frozen for a very long time and also was frozen through a period when we saw high inflation. Now, there's a £24,000 gap between those two figures, between where the higher rate tax threshold should be if it had gone up with inflation. And bear in mind, if it had gone up with inflation, those people just on the cusp now of paying higher rate tax who were just earning £50,000, they wouldn't actually be getting a better deal than the person in 1997. They'd just be getting an equal deal as them. So it would have needed to go to £74,000 just to keep things level, just so that you effectively had the same standard of living, okay, as that person. So there's a £24,000 gap. Then that means that basically Britons are paying an extra 20% tax on that £24,000. Well, that's £4,800 a year. That's £400 a month, right? So, and that would be £400 a month in your pocket, okay? Not £400 a month that's like a pay rise where it gets taxed. It's £400 a month landing in your bank account every month. That would certainly make you feel considerably richer. There aren't many people who wouldn't make feel considerably richer on 50 grand, but they wouldn't even be any richer. They'd only be in the same position as that person in 1997. And that's quite a stark illustration of what's going on here and why you've got people on relatively high earnings going, well, yeah, actually, like, I don't know where it's all going. Like, I know I'm earning loads of money. I know I'm really lucky. I know I shouldn't complain. But, like, where's it going? You know, it's just gone. And I'm not able to save and invest in the way that I'd like to. And if you look at that 60% tax trap, I've banged on about this so many times, but that was introduced by Alistair Darling, and that £100,000 hasn't moved. If that had gone up with inflation, it'd be £150,000. And it hasn't gone up with inflation. And in fact, the 45p tax level that was introduced, you know, post-financial crisis has come down from 150 to 125. So we're not doing ourselves any favours here. And then you look at it and you go, and why is this country struggling so much with growth?
I think the psychological aspect is quite important when you talk about inflation there, because it's almost like we're told that 50,000 must be wealthy because that's a higher rate tax. It might be slightly different if we're told that £75,000 is higher rate. And you're like, okay, then I can see that I feel rich. So the psychology is really important. Nice segue here. You have spoken to a money psychologist, Vicky Raynal. I've just downloaded her book, by the way, about how you can feel wealthier whatever you earn. So what did Vicky say?
Vicky is a, you know, regular columnist for us. She's got a couple of things that, you know, she's saying, like, number one, realize you're hardwired to compare with others. So we are evolutionary hardwired to compare ourselves to others. In early human societies, status was directly linked to survival and reproduction. Higher status meant more access to resources, stronger alliances to protect us from threats, and therefore greater survival advantages. I would argue there's still a certain status thing amongst people who earn lots of money about having loads of kids. It's definitely more for four children families. In those kind of like swaggering high earners. Some of them have got like an unbelievable amount of kids. And it's not just so that they can justify buying humongous SUVs. but Vicky says, fast forward to 2025 and making comparisons is easier than ever before. Social media means that we compare ourselves not just to those around us, but to others the world over, flaunting their lifestyles, holidays, and even their yachts and private jets. To make matters worse, Vicky says, algorithms pick up on our appetite for this aspirational content and present it to us with greater frequency, making it appear that exuberant wealth is more prevalent than it actually is. So basically, just remember that those things you're seeing, they're people putting their best lives on show. Because let's face it, how many people stick a photo on Instagram of standing on the station platform in the rain on a Tuesday? I mean, I know people do because, like, some people just can't help but share everything they do in their lives. But it's like, no, it's like, here's a nice photo of my holiday. Because actually, you've got to remember that a lot of these social media platforms are basically just photo sharing platforms. And it's like, you share a nice photo. I've taken a nice photo. Here it is. You know, probably we'd all be happier if we still lived in a world where you had to go down to the chemists and get your photos developed. And then the only people who could see them were the people that you got them out for and showed them to in your house, which very much limited the effect that Vicky's talking about here. But that's not the world that we live in. So just remember that stuff. Going on to number two, don't misconstrue what you see. Our evolutionary goggles have not adapted to a world in which buying on credit is more prevalent than ever. Social media showcases spending, not wealth. Easy to forget. Designer bags, sports cars, etc. They might have a heap of debt behind them. And this is very true. Is never ceases to amaze me the number of people driving around in this country in incredibly expensive cars. Okay? Like the amount of like 60, 70, 80, 100,000 pound cars on the roads is off the charts. As someone who has been obsessed with cars since a very young age, I can assure you that if you ever saw a Lamborghini when I was 10 years old,
you would just go, oh, your mind would be blown. Oh, I mean, you know, I know I work in Kensington and I know I cycle through London every day, but barely bat an eyelid now, you know. But most of those cars are being bought on what would be described as the never never by our parents' generation, but is now known as car finance. They're PCP deals. People are financing the depreciation. They don't own the car. They're effectively renting it for a period of time and they pay the depreciation over that time. And then they could choose to buy it outright at the end, but most of them just hand it back. Maybe lots of people own the Lamborghinis, but most of the Range Rovers and the Land Rover Defenders and the things like that that you're seeing being driven around, they're on finance, okay? Remember, your parents had it easier. Aha.
I was thinking, my parents' burgundy Volvo, they had it easier. Like, oh, no, you mean generally.
But your parents probably paid for their burgundy Volvo outright.
Oh, goodness me, of course they did.
Whereas the people like your parents, not necessarily your parents, but the people of your parents' kind of level in society and status nowadays, driving around in also in Volvos, but now they are XC90 SUVs that once you've added the extras on are coming to like £70,000-£80,000.
It is almost ever driving that sort of car.
Yeah, it is almost certain that those people have not bought that car outright, that they've bought it on finance, because that's how most new cars are sold. Also, like, going on to this, remember your parents had it easier, is like company cars. When I was a kid, loads of people's, and it was usually their dads. It's quite sexist here, but it was usually their dads, but it was also their mums sometimes, okay? Loads of people's parents had company cars. My dad had company cars. The tax regime on company cars was much more friendly back then, and he had great cars. He loved cars as well, and he'd always choose the best possible car that he had. Like, so my dad, you know, I can list them, right, that I remember, okay? There was Rover SD1s. They were amazing. Then he had a BMW 7 Series. Then he had a Saab 9000 Turbo. That was epic, that car. Faster than a Lotus 0 to 60. The car that he really, really, really wanted, though, was a Jag. And he wasn't allowed a Jag because the boss had a Jag and the boss didn't want anybody else to have a Jag as well. My dad pushed this and pushed this and pushed this for years because actually the Jag did fit into the price bracket of car that he was allowed. And then he finally got the Jag and he had a couple of Jags. And then unfortunately he wrote his last one off and he ended up with a Mercedes estate. But those are all company cars.
I'm not like, sure which is the unfortunate bit there. That he wrote it off or he ended up with a Mercedes.
Yeah, he didn't buy those cars outright. And because he used to have to travel for work, he used to get his petrol paid as well. And he had parking at work. It was like, it's just a completely different, you know, scenario to the one that most people have now. And so Vicky says, you know, another common statement I hear in the consulting room is my parents have done a lot better at my age. She says, while it's natural to use our parents as a benchmark, economic and social realities have changed dramatically. Affordability of homes, cost of living, length of education before entering the workforce make it significantly harder to accumulate wealth today than it was 40 years ago. Yet, as many struggle to gauge whether they are where they should be financially, they compare themselves to their parents, feeling they can't consider themselves wealthy if they haven't achieved the same milestones. And I think that's true. I think certainly in terms of, you know, the big detached family home and things like that, it's much harder. It's much less attainable. And one thing that is much less attainable actually is the thing that always gets trotted out on these kind of are you rich stories is private school fees. Private school fees have risen so much above inflation that your ability as an individual to pay for your kids to go to private school is totally different to like the ability of the same person as you 20 years ago, 30 years ago to do the same thing. Yet people, that's something people latch onto. They're like, well, I went to private school, but I can't afford to send my kids there. So I'm just not doing that well. And, you know, back to the whole do you feel rich thing. I guarantee if you've got two kids in private school and you're paying 15 grand a year for them to go to private school, then your £100,000 salary is not going to make you feel very rich at all.
Right, we're going to leave this to one side. If you want to read that article, it is very interesting. And also, Vicky's got a book, so you can buy that as well. But saying that, not only might you feel not wealthy now, you are likely to not actually be wealthy in retirement. So another day, another piece of research telling us that we're all stuffed. But this time it's a little more serious given the proximity to retirement of those people surveyed. So just 28% of those aged between 45 and 60 are on track to meet their retirement savings goals. On the plus side, it seems Gen Z, Gen Z, whatever, are a little bit more optimistic. 50% aged between 13 and 28. I don't even know if I've even thought about anything like that at 13. But anyway, said they were confident about meeting their pension targets. So the exuberance of youth, Simon, who knows? But what is all this about?
Right. Sometimes we publish a story that really chimes with readers and resonates. And sometimes it's one that sort of slightly catches you out and surprises you. Normally, you know which ones it's going to be. But this one, you know, it really got people clicking on it and reading it. Now, the moment that happened, I did think, well, of course it did. It's talking about Generation X. It's talking about people aged between 45 and 60 in this kind of rough generational, you know, approximation here. And it's like, talk about the sweet spot of readers for This Is Money financial site. And actually, it's also because, you know, there's some truth in this. And what's going on here? Why are Generation X really worried about their retirement? Well, two things. Firstly, depending on what end you're at of this, you're going to be approaching retirement an awful lot faster and thinking about it a lot more. The top end of Generation X are, you know, right on their way to it and going, hang on a minute, I actually don't have anywhere near as much time left as I thought before the age at which I wanted to retire, and I'm looking at my pension and I'm looking at all these reports about how much I need, and the two numbers do not match up. Those who are at the bottom end of that, 45, so I'm technically Generation X, I'm 46, right, but I'm right at the bottom end of it, have got a lot more time on their side, but they're also likely to possibly have been doing slightly better on the pension thing. And this is because Generation X is a bit of a generation that fell through the cracks. So they fell between the better defined benefit pensions that the generations before them had, the final salary schemes, and the efforts to then get people saving more early into defined contribution schemes that came later with auto-enrollment. So many of them will have started off in defined benefit pension schemes for companies, but then the company closed the defined benefit pension scheme. So then they got shipped into the defined contribution scheme. Maybe the companies weren't paying as much attention to that as they should have been. Maybe the people didn't join them. Maybe when they moved jobs, they didn't join the defined contribution pension scheme. So they've lost out on that kind of like guaranteed retirement income that was had before. But then what they also haven't benefited from is auto enrollment, which opts people into a pension unless they opt out, and means that there is a generation of people now who have been investing for a pension since they were in their early to mid 20s, because they just got opted in and, you know, it's been a great success. Most people don't opt out.
If it is you, Simon, and you are squeaky bum time, is it too late?
No, it's not too late. It's never too late. The best time to start investing is 20 years ago. The second best time is right now. You need to work out where you stand. Don't stick your head in the sand. Get together all of the information that you've got on your pensions and the various pensions that you might have. Maybe you might be someone who's got a number of these. You might have a defined benefit pot that you've got. You might have some defined contribution pots around the place, and work out where you might stand. So the way to do this is, if it's a defined benefit pot, get the letter out or contact your pension provider and ask them to give you a pension projection. They will give you a projection for the income that you should get from that pension at a certain date, your retirement date, basically, in that pension scheme. Now, bear in mind that if you make that 65 rather than 60, you're going to get a higher income. Okay, changing that number does make a difference. Okay, so it might be that, like, when you join that pension scheme, you just thought, oh yeah, I want to retire at 60. Whereas now you've got, yeah, there's no point, I'm not retiring at 60. So, and you're more likely to accept 65. So, you know, consider that. Secondly, defined contribution pots. You might have a number of small pots, but once you add them up, every little helps. And then what you've got now. And then you can look at a pension calculator, which can show you how that might grow and whether you might be on track. And if you go to thisismoney.co.uk/pension calculator, you can find ours, or Google pension calculator, you'll find lots of them. If you then want to work out how much you might need in terms of income in retirement, I would look at the PLSA's figures, the benchmark figures for income in retirement. Again, I don't have those to hand, but look them up and they will tell you what you might need for a basic retirement, a moderate retirement, and a comfortable retirement. Bear in mind the numbers are after tax, but also bear in mind they don't include your state pension. The state pension at the moment is about £11,500, and it should keep going up with inflation, thanks to the triple lock, or maybe even more than inflation. So all those things come into play, and you might find out that you're not in as bad a position as you think you are, but you need to save more. The power of compounding, you know, it works. So get money, more money into your pension, or another savings scheme. But the great thing about a pension is you get tax relief on the money that you pay in. So you get an instant 25% uplift to take you back to where you were before basic rate tax. And then if you're a higher rate taxpayer, of which, as we discussed earlier, there's an awful lot more of those now, you get the rest of the uplift as well. And it means that you're getting an instant uplift on your money. You've got more money going into the pot. Get it invested. Keep doing it regularly. And over time, it should grow. And, you know, maybe you might not get to that magical, you know, dream of retirement that you had, but you're certainly going to get a much better retirement than if you just do nothing about this.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Lisa Kaplan from Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Lisa, we're getting to that time of year when everybody is about to start thinking about doing things and then leaving them to the last minute and doing it in a rush. I bet you love this time of year. But we have a listener question from someone who is going to be prepared. What should I be thinking about now so I don't end up in a rush sourcing my finances at the end of the tax year?
Thanks, Simon. It's a great question. And yes, I'm always going to encourage people to get prepared early. It's not early anymore. You need to start thinking about things now. Yes, you can contribute until the day before the end of the tax year to most SIPs and certainly to the Charles Stanley ISA and SIP, that's possible. But there's stuff you need to be thinking about now. Do you want to tidy up your portfolio? Are there things you want to sell? Think about doing it now or after the tax year end, because you may want to set off some losses against your gains. And, you know, you've got your £3,000 allowance, you know, how much of that do you want to use? So if you need to do some work on your portfolio, look at how things are doing and what you want to tidy up and sell or buy, for that matter. The other area where I would encourage people to get moving is if you want to make an additional pension contribution. Particularly if you're self-employed, coming to the end of the year, how much can you afford to put away this year? It's very tax effective. And if you're self-employed, no one is taking care of that for you. I would add, if you don't have a pension yet, you need to get moving on opening one now. Yes, you can do so online. Obviously, I'm going to say through Charles Stanley Direct, other providers are available, but just get going on that sooner rather than later. Get it open and then you can make the contribution later. So long answer, I'm afraid, but I think people do start to need to start thinking about it now-ish.
Especially, I suppose, if it's something that involves two steps, if it involves you selling some investments to make your capital gain and then reinvesting the money, the later you leave it, the more chance you've got of missing that deadline.
Yes, and if you are reinvesting, just remind people about the 30-day rule. Either reinvest in something else, but you can't reinvest within 30 days for it to be effective for capital gains tax.
Great. Lisa, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Energy bills will be going up by more than expected from April. So Ofgem revealed this week a bigger than expected jump in the price cap, up by £111 to £1,849 from April the 5th, meaning pricier energy for those on variable tariffs, which is thought to be around 4 in 5 households. But could you save by fixing? So Simon, just a quick recap, £1,849 is the energy price cap, not necessarily what you're going to be paying, but what is it? Why is it going up so much?
Wholesale energy costs. The cost of gas, the cost of electricity has been going up, unfortunately, and that means that the energy price cap is going to go up by more. As you said, it's for the average household. So if you live in a bigger house, you'll pay more. If you live in a smaller property, you'll pay less. And also, you can control some of this by how much energy you use, how much gas or electricity. I don't think there's quite the concerted effort going on there as there was a couple of years ago when we had the energy price spike. But energy bills are still really expensive. I think most of us hoped that they would have gone back down much closer to where they once were than this number. I mean, really, if we were talking about where they once were, we'd be talking about just over £1,000 a year. So, you know, it is painful for people. What you can do now, though, that you couldn't do during the energy price spike is you can actually fix, and you can actually fix for less than the energy price cap. There is nowhere near the competition that there once was, but there is quite a bit of competition in terms of offering people better deals. And so, for example, we looked at the best fixes available at 7:30 a.m. on the 25th of February that undercut the price cap by a distance. And you could fix for 12 months without Fox the market with the average annual bill cost of £1,650. Outfox the market had a number of fixes, so it's got a 12-month fix, an 18-month fix, a two-year fix. They get more expensive. The two-year fix you could fix below the price cap at £1,672. But you then also got E.ON, British Gas, OVO, EDF, Sainsbury's Energy, So Energy. You know, all of those are offering tariffs below the price cap. So if you do want to fix, then it is well worth considering. I know that our very own editor Lee Boyce has fixed his energy bills and is a great advocate of doing this. You fixed your energy bills?
I did the other day, yep. Large reason, and it was with Octopus, large reason is because there are zero charges should I decide that I want to get another tariff, which I thought, well, that sort of is a bit of a no-brainer, isn't it? But I mean, I'm not advocating this for anyone else. I just thought for me, it sort of seemed to make sense.
As someone who hasn't fixed his energy bills, I must admit that does sound like a bit of a no-brainer. And I am an Octopus customer, of which obviously the chance of you being an
Octopus... Did you not get the email too?
I just probably ignored it. The chances of you being an Octopus customer are greatly increased nowadays due to the fact that Octopus is well on his way to just making every single person in the country an Octopus customer. It's the largest supplier now. But yeah, so, you know, check it out. Go to thisismoney.co.uk/energy and you can check the tariffs that you could get and see if you could save by fixing. And do you need a better recommendation than Georgie's done it, Lee's done it? I haven't done it.
Right. The speculation around cash ISAs continues. We have, of course, the spring statement. I keep calling it the autumn statement coming up, so forgive me. I just don't know my seasons. But the Chancellor will be making some... Well, I don't know. That's the thing, Simon. I mean, what are we expecting? Just briefly, before we go into cash ISAs, we do have a spring statement coming up in around about a month's time. We are going to be hearing a lot more speculation about things that could happen in there. But do you expect much to change? It's not really a time for sort of budget announcements and tax rises and all that sort of thing. But never say never.
No, personally, I don't think that much is going to change. I genuinely do think the Chancellor is going to stick to the spring statement element of this and not turn it into a spring budget. She's made it clear that she's only intending on doing one budget a year. We've had Chancellors who've said that before and then backslid on that fairly rapidly. But I do think backsliding on that straight away would probably be a bad move. And I also think just leaving stuff alone might be wise. I mean, on the basis that I suspect Rachel Reeves is not going to unwind the employer national insurance contributions, the farmers who came up with a plan to try and improve the inheritance tax thing were dismissed completely out of hand. The pensions industry pointing out that there are a number of flaws in the pensions and inheritance tax thing appear to be being ignored, but on the basis that there's a consultation and that can be kicked down the road. I would imagine that probably stuff will be left well enough alone. And I shared my views on this last week, but I don't think the cash ISA limit is going to be hacked back. There might be some talk that there'll be a review of cash ISAs, but we should be moving in the direction of simplification.
Okay, Simon, you spoke to an investment expert recently. Just tell us who she is.
It's Carol Knight. She is the CEO of the Investment and Saving Association, TISA. Now, what's interesting is this is an association that, as its name suggests, is also concerned with investing as well as saving. This is not just someone talking their book because they do cash ISAs or something like that. And what she is pointing out is that actually amongst, you know, investment companies, investment platforms, you know, all of the people involved in saving investing in this country, this is not considered to be a good idea. This would be a backward step. It would be anti-simplification. And also that it wouldn't probably encourage anybody to invest any more money in the UK stock market, which is where the reasoning behind this slightly mad plan is coming from.
All right, well, let's listen to a bit of that interview now.
When we first heard this rumour at the moment, because it's not being confirmed at all, it was, I'm afraid, a moment where my head went into my hands and I thought, what in the world is everybody trying to do here? We know the government is very keen to drive up investment levels, particularly investing in British UK companies. And we completely agree that that's a very good objective. We need to get growth in this country, and that is one of the channels that we could use in order to do that. However, simply reducing the annual subscription limit for cash ISAs will not achieve that aim. Many people in this country do not invest. They save in cash. And a lot of research has been done. We've done a lot. Other organisations have also done a lot. And the findings are always the same. People choose not to invest for three key reasons. There is a lack of confidence. There is a lack of knowledge. And there's a fear of losing their money. There is this concept that people like me don't invest. I mean, that's not true. But simply reducing the cash ISA limits won't change any of that. A lot of the research we did found that 70% of people who saved in a cash ISA and had more than £5,000 already saved had never even considered saving in a stocks and shares ISA. Reducing the limit won't suddenly make them think about it. There are other ways that can be used in order to give people that confidence, to overcome the lack of knowledge. All they'll do, I mean, all we see that people will do is still saving cash. They will use other saving schemes. They may hit a tax requirement on the interest that they earn, or they don't save it at all. It just stays in their bank account. And if they're anything like me, then it just disappears. And none of those actions will achieve the government's aim in achieving investment in UK companies. There's also the consideration that for some sectors of society, investing is not necessarily the best thing to do. There is a general agreement that what you really need to look for is 3 to 6 months of outgoing saved in cash. And that in itself can be a challenge sometimes, but also for older people. I mean, investments are generally viewed as a long-term objective. If you've got objectives of sort of 5-10 years, preferably, well, for some of us, myself included, that's not necessarily the time frame I'm looking at in which I need to access my money. So for people who are older, cash saving is the most appropriate. So again, by restricting the limit that's available within a cash ISA, you are reducing the options and the opportunities for people to care for themselves as they get older, potentially, and need social care and what have you. We have spent years trying to make the ISA scheme simpler. The ISA scheme is the most popular saving scheme in the country. People trust it. They understand it generally. And a lot of work has been done trying to make the scheme simpler for people to understand and have the confidence in saving in. If this change is made, it will complicate the system tremendously. It will go back to what we worked hard at getting rid of. It will make the opportunity to transfer between cash and stocks and shares far more complex. There will be a whole raft of regulations that will need to be changed. That will take time. It will cost money. We can't see good outcomes coming out of this. Really support the aim, but we believe there are much better ways to actually achieve the objective that the government is looking for.
See, it undermines the system because a lot of the reasons alongside that you gave for not investing, one of the things that comes alongside that is people just go, well, they just changed the rules on me. They're always tinkering on it. I put it in, it's tax friendly now. They just changed the rules. And we've seen this with pensions before. So is the investment industry or the people suggesting this within the investment industry shooting themselves in the foot by even raising it?
I think it's a risk. I think there's two aspects there. I think the speculation that goes on can be hugely damaging. And you referred to the pensions before the budget came out. Absolute disaster. There was so much speculation about the risk to the tax-free allowance that's possible to take out from a pension when you retire. And so many people withdrew their money from a pension only to find that nothing happened, but they couldn't put it back in. So all of a sudden that money's come out of a pension. What are they going to do with it? You know, that's a huge risk. And there is also this concept that, well, several things. Yes, it can undermine trust in what the government are going to do and lose confidence in everything anyway. And, you know, we really need to be building confidence and enthusiasm and positivity in this country, not going in the opposite direction. And the third thing, I think, is also there is this mistrust of financial services companies. And I have seen some of the reports that say, well, investment companies would say that anyway, because they just want more of our money. I can't begin to explain that is really not the case. I have not always worked in this industry. I've done many other jobs in my life, came into this industry fairly late in life. And I think what has surprised me more than anything else is how many people in this industry really genuinely want people to succeed. They want people to make money from their savings and investments. We can't magic money into people's pockets. Sadly, there is no magic money tree. But there are so many people, so many companies in this industry who genuinely, wholeheartedly want to help people do better financially. If people do better financially as individuals, we all benefit without a doubt.
Well, that was Carol Knight there, CEO of the Investing and Saving Alliance, speaking about all the cash ISA speculation. Right, finally, Simon, your stat of the week.
Okay, my stat of the week is this. The price gap between houses and flats has hit a 30-year high, according to Zoopla. It revealed that the average house value is now £319,500, whereas the average value of a flat is £191,300. So the house is 67% more expensive than the flat.
That is it for this week. Thank you so much to Simon, and thank you for listening. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news just to go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions, team, anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
Yes, if you would like to email us, then you can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us, because we still call it that, at This Is Money. Or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and join in the debate and read the comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.